Okay, so thanks very much. Lovely to see you all. I thought I'd give you something else to look at other than me. So I've got some slides, and it's kind of a typical academic thing to have it as a crutch to kind of use to kind of hopefully keep myself to time as well. And I'm delighted to follow two such interesting, stimulating speakers as Nick and Kathy. Very pleased that Nick can set out the bigger energy system context. I find myself quite a lot these days talking about the wider energy system, because that's what we've got to think about, the whole kind of wide challenge. But tonight I'm going to indulge my kind of engineering nerd and go into some of those sorts of challenges. And I'm very pleased to Fiona, who I was talking to earlier, who actually got the weak literary joke in the title. Anyway, I'll move on. So Kathy and Nick have both alluded to some of the sort of market challenges and some of the sort of structural and regulatory sort of issues. I'm not really going to dwell on them. I mean, these are some of the things that we can see, present at the moment and looking forward in terms of the investment that we need to get. And of course, some of these are outside of our control, but quite a lot of them, you could argue, are within our control, within the industry, government, or the regulator. And we could discuss how much these are good things, bad things, and what we could do about them. But I'm not going to talk about all that stuff. I'm going to take an engineer's perspective instead tonight. We already know, we've heard about it, that the system is changing towards more use of variable renewables, wind and solar. Hydro counts as a variable renewable. It depends on the weather as well. And what is now being termed quite often inverter-based resources. So that's the kind of electrical technology using power electronics that connects the source of the energy to the electricity system. So these are kind of, we're not using to the same extent these kind of big thermal power stations where we made heat to make lots of steam under high pressure to turn a turbine, which uses a synchronous generator to generate the electricity. And there are particular features of that that we're not getting anymore. And well, when it's windy and sunny. When it's not windy and sunny, well, that's another story. So how can we make efficient use of whatever low carbon energy is available at the time that it's available? How can we meet the demand, pretty much all the demand, pretty much all the time? Can we keep the system stable while we're doing that? And can we do all of the above at least cost? So yeah, there's not a lot for us to do, really. Now, the thing is that stuff happens, and it's always happened, and disturbances happen on the system, and that's what we've got to be able to manage. It's what Nick, when he was in charge of the system operator, that's what his people were all concerned with all of the time. And if we're not careful, some people are quite likely to blame the transition to renewables on whatever happens as a result. And I think it's very important to be clear about what's going on, because these sorts of things have always happened. And sometimes, you can look around the world, there's basically a national or a regional blackout somewhere in the world. Once or twice, three times every year. We just, hope it's not us. And we have to make sure that it isn't us. But we can't say it will never happen. It could happen. We just need to do our best to make sure it doesn't and manage this transition in the best way. And if we are hearing somebody who's blaming it on wind, we have to get out and look and see what's actually happened and explain what did happen. As, here was the Scottish problem written a different way from a couple of years ago. Okay, my daughter found that headline quite amusing, which you could probably tell from my accent. Now, that particular event did lead to disconnection of 1.1 million electricity customers, spread across, actually, as it happened in England and Wales. In Scotland, we got away with it because of the settings of some of the devices. But it had a particular impact in the southeast of England, affecting particular trains that kind of saw system frequency fall and kind of gave up and needed people to go out with laptops to restart them. Now, one thing that a lot of people talk about is, as a consequence of losing all that thermal plant and the synchronous machines, is a reduction of the system's inertia. That's just a store of energy in terms of the rotating mass. Now, this particular event, it wasn't to do with the lack of inertia, but it did show what happened if you fail to manage system frequency and keep it within the acceptable operating limits. A lot of the plant is designed only to operate within those certain limits, and you could get into a cascade where you end up with a blackout. That has happened in other parts of the world. And on this event, things tripped because of a falling frequency that shouldn't have done, and other things that should have responded to the fall of frequency failed to do so. And if those, all of these things hadn't happened, we wouldn't have disconnected 1.1 million customers. Now, good news, there are things we can do about this. So we can make use of a variety of sources of energy, the kinds of batteries that Semcor is developing, for example, with the power electronics and with the appropriate controls to respond quickly and arrest these changes and stabilize the system. And even better news, the system operator now realizes this and has, you know, kind of articulated some markets to get those things providing that kind of service. Okay, my second challenge. One of the things that these synchronous generators give you is current, lots of current. That's very dangerous when there's a short circuit somewhere on the network. But it also helps you to identify automatically where that fault is and to isolate it safely with the appropriate equipment before the whole system comes down. So if we're getting rid of all that synchronous plant and replacing it with other stuff, there's a lack of short circuit current in certain places that might mean that faults are not identified and cleared in the right way, which could threaten the stability of the system. The good news, though, is there are things we can do about it, albeit we're still working it out. We could change the characteristics of the power electronic controls, or we could change the algorithms in the protection equipment. Something that Nick has alluded to already, which actually is either an opportunity or a threat, depending on how we manage it, is the growth of distributed resources, small-scale stuff, you know, solar panels on roofs, single wind turbines. Actually, there's a lot of other, you know, combined heat and power plant, waste to power plant, connected within the distribution networks. Also, potentially lots of flexible demand, such as Nick was talking about earlier. So they can really help the system in terms of managing those variations. But unfortunately, on that event in August 9th, 2019, they hindered the situation. They made it worse, not helped by the fact that the system operator, well, the distribution network operators don't really know what it's doing or how it's going to behave. And that's, you know, it seems to have grown without us really realizing. So we need to get a handle on that and work out, you know, better monitoring and utilize the control capability to help the grid rather than hinder it. So, you know, could be a good thing if we do it well. Okay, I'm going to spend a few moments on this one because this kind of picks up some of, I think, what Cathy was talking about the sun, and there's lots of wind, and actually there's other times when there's not so much. So what we've plotted here is we've taken a demand in each hour of the year, and we've kind of just sorted those numbers from the smallest on the right to the biggest on the left. That's what we call the load duration curve or the demand duration curve. We could, that's the dashed lines. And we could also look in each hour of the year and say, well, how much wind power is available in that hour? And solar power and hydropower. In other words, all these variable renewables. That's what I'm calling a residual demand. And we could stack that up in the same way for history, what we've observed, or we could do some modeling of what might happen in the future. So we've got a 2020 simulation. Okay, this was done in 2019 based on what we thought could have happened if we hadn't had the pandemic. So that's the kind of solid blue line. We've also, grateful to my colleague Callum McKeever for doing the modeling here, the yellow line for a 2030 GB scenario with 40 gigawatts of offshore wind, and a 2040 scenario is the green line with even more wind. So the point here is that we've got challenges at both ends of that curve. When it's not windy and sunny, what else are we going to use to meet the demand for electricity? And by the way, I'm not very happy with the demand numbers here. They should be higher. I took these from the European Network of Transmission System Operators. So I don't think it quite captures what we're trying to do with heat pumps. EVs, you can kind of smooth it out a bit, but heat pumps especially. But at the other end, a bit below the line, that's times we've got a surplus. So rather, as Cathy was talking about, what are we going to be able to use it to do? We don't want to waste it. So that's going to have some kind of cost if we have to curtail that really useful, nice, low carbon output. And we could look in at single days. That kind of loses the kind of the sequential nature of what's really happening. And zoom in, here's one particular day that just happens to come out of the modeling. We kind of modeled a kind of typical weather year, looked at what would be going on. So the residual demand curve is that orange line. So it's not very windy and sunny that day, a day in winter. We might try and smooth out that by using all this flexibility of EVs and whatever else we can do. Let's get a flat green line, let's say, very idealistically, but that still leaves quite a lot of energy under the line to be met in that day by something other than wind, solar and hydro, which we're using as much of it as we can get on that day. So that's quite a lot of energy. And if we had a week like that, I mean, I've heard this term they use in Germany of Dunkelflaute, You know, it's not inconceivable we'll have a week quite similar to that. So where are we going to get all that energy from? Storage could be a big part of that, whether it's stored hydrogen manufactured via low carbon means, it could be compressed air, such as Kathy was talking about. You might say, well, by that time, we will have lots of electric vehicles with batteries. Well, couldn't we use those batteries? So here's a bit of logic on the right-hand side, trying to work out, well, how much energy might that equate to? So another colleague, James Dixon, kind of had a bit of a go at this. So you come up with 330 gigawatt hours. That's about a third of what you would need on one of these days. So it helps, but doesn't tell the whole story. We need this flexibility, of course, to kind of meet those changes of residual demand and fill in those gaps. There's lots of things that might do this, including flexible demand. Now, you want it to be able to kind of ramp up or down quickly. Wind farms can do it if it's already windy, but you also want to be able to rely on it to be operate tomorrow or next week or the week after. And when it's running, you want it to be able to continue to run and continue to produce energy to fill in those gaps, those Dunkelflauten. So I think we need these three characteristics. Now, unfortunately, none of these things is perfect and does all of it at the same time, which means we need a mix. Okay, so I think we still need to work out how we get the right mix. And here's a bit that Kathy's talked about already, about getting enough network capacity. So she talked about the constraint costs are going up. You know, we can't use all of the nice wind in the north. We have to reduce the output, use something else in the south. Unfortunately, that tends to mean fossil fueled. Let's try and do as little as that as possible. And, you know, the cost of doing that has to be picked up somewhere. And yeah, we can get more wind connecting in Scotland, even if we had only a fraction of the ScotWind results from the leasing of the Scottish seabed that came out in January, it's still a lot more and will change those flows a lot. But those are those four East Coast bootstraps that have been proposed. Well, hey, it looks like we need to get on and do it. It's not just the offshore stuff. We need to still need to get the power on through the onshore as well, you know, and as well as that. By the way, here's a coordinated offshore network design. It's very high level, but from 10 years ago. And by coincidence, the scenario we looked at for that for 2030 was 40 gigawatts of wind in offshore in UK waters. Hey, wow, who got that target from there? So we just need to do a lot of this. Okay, my last one before I wrap up. Managing control interaction. A lot of this power electronics is very flexible. It can do a lot of stuff really quickly. But at the moment, a lot of it is designed kind of ignorant of what else is on the system. It pretends the system is a kind of some sort of idealized equivalent. The real world has all these things interacting with each other, and it does happen from time to time. They interact adversely, and these oscillations appear almost out of nowhere. And we were lucky in August 2021 that they disappeared again without causing anything really bad and starting to trigger a cascade of outages. So these inverter connected resources bring lots of opportunities, but also lots of challenges. Lots of challenges around the kind of modeling of them and analysis. There are challenges around the commercial confidentiality of what's under the lid. What is it really doing? It can be changed really quickly and easily. It's just software, provided we know what to change it to. And we need new tools and methods for the system operator to make sure all these things are going to behave in a kind of nice, controlled, you know, stable manner. Okay, what I've not talked about, you might have heard, you know, engineers, electrical engineers talking about system strength. I've deliberately not talked about that because I don't actually find it a very helpful term. Because when you hear different engineers talking about it, they're talking about usually three different things which could be solved actually in different ways, even though they are all at the same time, you could argue, consequences of the closure of thermal power plant using synchronous machines. So let's get rid of that term. Okay, so there we are. I've had my six challenges in search of some order. But I don't want to end on a negative about how difficult it all is, because there are fantastic opportunities which we should be realizing. And I believe we can. Work is already started on a lot of these things. But if there's, for me, one overarching challenge to all of this, it is this question of whether we are investing enough in getting the right knowledge and skills within the sector to solve all these challenges. Okay, I won't use the additional slides, you'll be glad to know. Thanks very much.